Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, yes, good evening. And our guest tonight is the absolute legend that signed Madonna, Talking Heads, Depeche Mode, Ice-T, Lou Reed, The Smiths and countless others, some of whom apparently were quite difficult to deal with. He's the vice president of Warner Brothers Records. He co-founded the Sire label, which he accurately describes as a smoking hit factory. And he discovered the Ramones, which surely makes him the godfather of punk. And after 60 years in the business, he's written a fantastic book about it, full of extraordinary incident and an insight. It's called Siren Song. Please welcome Seymour Stein. So, Seymour, thank you for coming. And we traditionally start by asking people about the place they grew up, which in your case was Brooklyn, and the music that they remember hearing at the time. Can you remember your earliest childhood memories of the kind of music that was playing?
Well, I go way back because we lived in a small two-bedroom apartment. I shared my bedroom with my sister, who's 6 years older than me, although she looks 6 years younger than me. But I heard a lot of her music, and it was, the mid to late 40s. There was some great, great music that I heard, and I started to hear some country songs early on. Bonaparte's Retreat was quite early, the late 40s, by K-Star. She was a pop singer. That was one of the songs. Open the Door, Richard. Do you know that song? Open the door, Richard. Richard, why don't you open? Which was sort of a rhythm and blues song. And I knew there was change in the air. In 1949, I believe, when I was about seven, I heard Fats Domino for the first time. And, The Fat Man, that was the song I think I first heard by him. Fell in love instantly. And I got to know the man very, very well, all during his life. I used to see him every time I went down to New Orleans when he was there. I got to see him. A great, great man. Lloyd Price, Lordy Miss Claudie, another, early R&B record.
Shaboom by the Chords, you mentioned?
That came later.
Yeah,
That's the fifth. That's 1954.
Yeah, 54.
Don't speed me up here, please.
Yeah. I think you're fine.
Let's go at 33 and a third.
Yeah, yeah.
Now.
No, fair
Not
enough.
78, 78 RPM. I heard G by the Crows.
Yeah.
That was probably the first doo-wop song I heard. And then Shaboom by the Chords, Hearts of Stone by Otis Williams and the Charms. And we had to figure out how many times he said no, no, no. You know the song Hearts of Stone, any of you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then saying no, 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 no. Your daddy knows. I thought you knew. Hearts made of stone. That was a very great, great song.
This is the most musical podcast we've ever
done. Oh, no. We've never had anybody.
I'm rather worried about we haven't cleared the publishing.
Oh, no, we're going to have to pay copyright on all this now. But you, at the age of whatever it was, about 16, you applied to Billboard.
15.
You applied to Billboard magazine.
I went up to, actually, earlier than that, I went up to Billboard when I was 13. And I wanted to go back in time to all of the music that I hadn't written down and written the charts on, which they broadcast every Saturday. And the billboard was located in the Palace Theater building on 47th Street and Broadway. And it was ground zero for the music business. And I quickly realized, you know, what the hell am I going backwards for? It's all here, you know, right here, you know, just a quick subway ride from Brooklyn where I grew up. And then I started really getting into what was going forward. They gave me some work to do, and I would commute. By the time I was 15 then, I would go from high school in Brooklyn, Lafayette High School, to to the Billboard offices and, work with Paul Ackerman, the music editor, or Tom Noonan, the chart editor. And they even I couldn't believe they paid me, you know. I mean, on Wednesday nights, some nights I would stay and listen to them pick the spotlight winners, which is what they called them, the picks of the week. And it was very important to win a spotlight from Billboard because the charts were very slow in those days, sometimes a month behind. And jukeboxes were very, very important back then. And the jukeboxes, they couldn't wait till a record hit the chart before they put it in the jukebox. So they would go by Billboard's ratings. And a great review in Billboard could mean anywhere from 50 to 75,000 records sold and bought by jukebox operators. That's before, you know, anybody else bought the records.
And the guy ran Billboard, Sid Nathan, who became your mentor, yes, wasn't he? And he launched a record label, and I think signed
King Records,
and signed King James Brown. And very early on, weren't you sent? He was sent on the road with James Brown.
I went on the road with James. That was much later. No, you're getting ahead of the, you know.
Yeah.
But no. I graduated high school, and I was thinking about, perhaps going to school for journalism, and Billboard offered me a full-time job, so I stayed there another couple of years, and then Sid Nathan, who was my greatest mentor, had many mentors, but he was the number one. The book is dedicated to him. And he said, look, do you want to be in the bleachers? Do you want to be an observer? Or do you want to be a player? Billboard, I love the people at Billboard, the reporters and everything, but they're not in the music business. You should come to Cincinnati full time and work for me. And I did, and I was there for about 2.5 or 3 years. And then I just missed New York too much. I couldn't, you know, Cincinnati is a nice town, beautiful border town on the river, on the Ohio River, and great music, country music, rhythm and blues, and blues. I came back, and I finally got a job with Lieber and Stoller, the greatest songwriters, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, and with George Goldner at Redbird Records. And they were located in the Brill Building, which was just a building with nothing but music people, publishers, small record labels, and managers and agents, and two incredible restaurants on the ground floor. One was Jack Dempsey's, and Jack Dempsey was the host there and greeted you as you walked in the restaurant. The other was the Turf, which was not as fancy, but famous for the Turf cheesecake. And when I started Sire, I'm skipping ahead a little, they didn't know what cheesecake was in England. And I would bring them over, and it gave me entree to so many people. You know, they just loved those cheesecakes.
When did you first come to the UK?
I think it was about 65, 66. Don't remember it exactly. And then soon after I started Sire Records, I came. I met this wonderful, wonderful man, Len Wood, L.G. Wood, who was the chairman of EMI Records, and what a gent. And King was distributed by EMI in most overseas territories, and Sid had me meet him, and he took he said Sid thinks you're going to make it in the music business, and one day, and that's enough for me. When you do, you'll come to England, and when you do, I want to be the first person that you see, because I'd like to help you. So I remembered all that, and on my first trip, I told him I'd like to see him, and he said, look, I'm going to send a car for you and take you right to my office before you even go to your hotel and everything. And so he sent this young Scottish lad to pick me up, and I couldn't understand a word he said. And, you know, that Scottish lad later became, well, his name was John Reed, and he became, you know, Elton's boyfriend, and then his manager as well. And but I couldn't, you know, he meets me, and he came from Glasgow, from I forget which area of Glasgow, but where the accent was so thick. So I said, you're taking me to see Mr. Wood. I said, where's the car? And he must have been, he said, a car, can I drive? I said, so he got a taxi, and we went, he must have misunderstood me. And I went to see, Len Wood, and he had all these albums there. He said, look, Capitol hasn't picked up any of these. And I said, well, I'm not surprised. They didn't pick up the Beatles. They rejected the Beatles not once but twice. He said, yes. He said, we have a lot of trouble with Capitol. And so that's where I got really started with artists like Barclay James Harvest, Renaissance, the Climax Blues Band, Kevin Ayers. I don't know if those names are familiar to you. But then what really, you know, made Sire, put us sort of on the map, was all their overseas companies started sending me records because, you know, they had companies everywhere. They were the biggest and the best record company there ever was. It was EMI. You can be very, as Englishmen, you can be very, very proud of that. And I got calls from everybody. And then I get this one record by a Dutch artist called Jan Akkerman. And I put the record on, and I loved it. And I called their Dutch company, which I believe was called Bovima, and I said, look, I'd like to put this record out. I said, we don't pay big advances. He said, oh, this record? You can have this record without any advance. Jan Akkerman just left the label. He said he went back to his old band. They're called Focus. I said, oh, really? So I said, and where can I find these? He said, well, they just got a job as the house band for the Dutch production of Hair. I got on a plane, you know, not knowing what I'd find, and the other members of the band, especially the flutist, a flautist, I should say, Thijs van Leer, was amazing. And I signed the band, and that became my first million-selling single and my first gold album, you know. And so that really got, you know, some money in the coffers.
And the other group round about similar time is Fleetwood Mac, isn't it?
Well, no, Fleetwood Mac, no, let's be fair. Let's be fair about all of that. No, I had really nothing to do with Fleetwood Mac, but I met this really nice young man, you know, a couple of years younger than me, and he was a producer at Decca, the number two company in the UK. And he produced his big, you know, band that he was producing was Don Mayall's Blues Breakers. And, you know, Don Mayall was a very rough guy and very talented. But, you know, if any of the musicians in the band wanted more money, he knew. I mean, Eric Clapton was lining up to be in his band. He would just fire them. So in 1 week, he fired Peter Green and Mick Fleetwood and, Mick V, you know. And so they were all so depressed. So and Mike was producing them. He said, look, you know, why don't we start your own band, you know, and we call it Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. And he had Blue Horizon Records, and the first album he put out went right to number one. Then he signed this other band called Chicken Shack, and there was a woman in it, Christine Perfect, later Christine McVie, and they broke too. And then I taught him a little, you know, but not really. He gives me too much credit. But he calls me up about 5 or 6 months into the label, and he says, Seymour, would you like to be my partner? I said, oh, come on. You know, don't tease me like this. You're red hot. He said, no, Seymour, I can't stand the running a record company. He said, I just want to make records. He said, I'll make it very easy for you. You know, I borrowed some money from my father. You just pay my father back and you got 50% of the company and you run it. And that's how I got involved with it. But I had nothing to do with the creative side of Blue Horizon Records. Very little. I mean, Mike, I did, Fleetwood Mac wanted, oh, it was a dream for them, and I got it accomplished for them. They wanted to go to Chicago and play with Muddy Waters and all those, you know, Chess musicians. And, of course, I knew Leonard Chess, and I said, you know, and he knew who Fleetwood Mac was. And, you know, I still am quite friendly with Leonard's son, Marshall Chess. And I brought them out to Chicago.
They thought
they were in heaven.
It mentions quite colourfully the whole Andy Warhol era going on in New York, and you going to Andy Warhol parties and running into various people. Have you got any memories of that?
Well, I knew Andy, you know. Andy liked...
Give us a description of one of those parties.
Oh, you don't really. I was too stoned. I mean, I couldn't, you know, I mean, if you want to know the truth. No, there was, he really liked the Ramones. He really liked Talking Heads and Richard Hell. He liked a pop band that I had, too, the Paley Brothers. And, you know, and in fact, he gave, there were two brothers, he gave Andy Paley a bunch of drawings, and unfortunately somebody stole them from him. Could you imagine what they would have been worth? It's terrible. But
a lot of your job is about finding bands and then developing them and changing them in a kind of A&R to try and get them ready.
I never changed anybody. I mean,
I was going to say the Ramones appeared when you first saw them to be already fully formed. You know, they'd worked out the way they looked. They'd worked out, I think, what their names were going to be.
Well, they did it all, not me. Yeah. I mean, I had nothing to.
How did they evolve? I mean, what was it like when you saw them the first time?
Well, I was very impressed. You know, once I got over. The first song they sang for me, and no, I was supposed to see them live, and I flew home from the UK. I got very sick, you know. I mean, I really, when I came here, worked my ass off. And I come back, and I was sick, and I couldn't go see them, so I sent my wife, And she went with Danny Fields, who had already seen them, and the legendary Danny Fields. And Linda came back raving about them. So I pulled myself together and I said, look, tomorrow I want to get them into a rehearsal studio. And I booked it for an hour. They must have played 18 songs in 20 minutes. So it wasn't that, it was maybe 25 minutes. Yeah. And so we used the rest of the time to work out the deal, you know. And they were so anxious, and we got along so well, and I loved them all. They were each, they may have looked a little the same, but every one of them was different, you know, from each other. And they all played a very, very major role in the band. And, you know, within a week, the album was done. And but I'm very sad, really. They never enjoyed the great success in America that I thought they should have deserved while they were alive. They're bigger now that they're dead, which is very sad. They would go to... I brought them to England to open for the Flaming Groovies. Do you know who the Flaming Groovies
are? Oh, yes.
Yes. So, and they blew the Flaming Groovies off. They didn't mean to, but, I mean, they didn't blow them. They went on first. And then, but they got all the publicity, you know. And a year later, I brought them back as the headliners with the Talking Heads. And at that time, Sire was distributed by Phonogram, and my main contact there was one of my dearest friends who died about a year ago. Nigel Grange, whose younger brother is probably the most powerful man in the music business today, Lucian Grange. And Lucian was 13 at the time, and Nigel brought him to see the Ramones and the Talking Heads, and he said to his brother, I want to be in the music business like you. And, you know, and he tells everybody that story. I mean, and... you know, but I feel very, very good about it.
Did England play an important part in the story of the Ramones, bringing them to England?
Oh, I think it did. I mean, they would love coming to England. They would play big theatres all up, you know, the north, even as far up as Scotland.
Well, they played a famous show at the Roundhouse, didn't they?
Which, pardon me?
They played a famous show at the Roundhouse, which
yes,
all the,
yes,
the members
absolutely.
Of the Clash and the Pistols.
Yes,
and
yes,
the
yes.
Banshees
I was
and,
there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't until much, much later that they were, you know, and only in a few cities where they got to, in America, where they got to play really big venues.
So was it easier to break people in Britain because it's smaller and the media's more concentrated?
Well, I mean, you had one radio station that went... Whoop, from the bottom to the top, the BBC, and so that made it a lot easier. And you had people who really knew what they were doing, John Peel and people like that. I love your country. It's really my second home. You know, I have a flat here. I used to come here. I used to spend maybe about 4 months or more in total in England every year, back and forth. And now maybe two and a half months a year, you know, if that. You know, I'm 76 years old.
Yeah. But the Talking Heads was the next major signing for Sire, and it's really,
I guess so.
It's just interesting. What you know, they're one of those groups like the Ramones. When I first heard them, saw them, I couldn't really imagine where they'd come from. They seemed so original. You know,
they were very original.
Extraordinary.
You know, I had heard about them, and every time I wanted to, you know, I heard they were playing. I was in England. That's when I was really spending a lot of time in England. So. I you know, but by this time, my wife and Danny were managing the Ramones. So the Ramones knew my every move. I come home, and, you know, the phone rings 15 minutes later. Surprise, it's Donny Ramone. He says, Seymour, we've got some great new songs, and we want you to hear them. I said, look, Donny, as you probably know, I've just walked in the door. I said, and it was a Sunday. I remember that it was a Sunday. I said, look, give me a day to catch up on Monday. Come in any time you want on Tuesday. He said, oh, no, we don't want to come to your office. We booked ourselves in Wednesday. We know you're free. And he said we're gonna play the songs to you. I said, great. No, I was very happy about that. So I said, I better check who the opening band is. And I called, and it was a band called The Shirts. I don't know if you've heard of them. They didn't make it that well. And they were managed by Hilly Kristal, who I loved. And I didn't even want to be seen before the Ramones went on, because Hilly was pushing me to sign them, you know. And Hilly, I did sign, the Dead Boys were Hilly's band, and I loved the Dead Boys, and I signed them. I just didn't, and the Shirts were not a bad band. I just didn't, you know, I didn't like them enough. So I'm standing outside this mid-November, but it was a beautiful, it was warm night out there on the Bowery. And I was standing there with Lenny Kaye from Patti Smith's band. And all of a sudden, when I thought the Shirts were going on, I hear, when my love stands next to your love. You know, I said, and I felt myself, I didn't even realize it at the time, I was being sucked into the out off the street and into CBGB. I said, this isn't the Shirts. So he said, oh, no, Hilly managed to get them a paying gig in Brooklyn. He says, this is the Talking Heads. Well, I'd never seen anything quite like it. You know, they were just a three-piece back then, and I was mesmerized for the whole gig. I was mesmerized. They had no crew. They had nothing. And here's this frail-looking woman. She, believe me, she's not frail. and she's fabulous. I love Tina. I love them all, you know. And I try to help her down off stage. She said, you know, and she said, no, we're okay. And then David says to me, we know who you are. He said, and he wrote down an address on a piece of paper. He said, this is our loft. I don't want to talk here. Come to our loft tomorrow. And it was, you know, and I did. And I offered them a deal for more money than I ever offered any band before them, you know. And
why did you do that, then? What did you see in them that you thought would be so profitable?
Magic. Magic. And they took the offer, you know, and at the time, they were so ahead of everybody, they were getting into video. And, you know, so they were spending a lot of time making videos and things. They also had gone to school together, which is where they met, up in Rhode Island, and they were going back and forth and everything. And it took them 11 and a half months, which almost killed me. I lost so much sleep over those, because there were seven major labels at the time. I said, somebody is going to see and hear what I've seen in this band. And, you know, I learned later from Tina that there were other offers, and we never discussed what they were, you know. But I'm sure they were probably more sizable. But they decided to go with me. And, you know, I mean, but those 11 and a half months, I lost a lot of sleep, I could tell you. I love that band.
Do you think they achieved the potential that they could have achieved? Do you think they could have sold more records than they did?
Well, I think they had quite a bit of success. I mean, don't you? But I think, look, I think they could have achieved more success. I think, you know, I think the Ramones could have, you know, I think all my bands, you know, and I don't think I'm to blame for it, you know. I mean, by this time, Warner Brothers was distributing Sire, and they actually liked the Talking Heads, and, you know, of course, I think all my bands should have sold more records, but the Talking Heads, I wouldn't say in particular, but you know, all of them.
What are the things that you look for? What are the things that you listen out for? Is it almost simple?
Almost always, it's the same thing. Songs. I'm a song man. I think that in my universe, that's what makes it all go around, are the songs. And it's been that way since before, when I was a child. You know, I heard a great song, you know, and I would go wild. But the thing is, look, a lot of people care mostly about the musicianship, and I don't underrate that at all. But, you know, these are young bands. Their playing is only going to get better, you know. But they've got to have songs to begin with. I mean, of course, when I heard the Smiths, not to jump ahead, I mean, I could recognize, you know, Donny Marr, how super he was. I mean, I think he was on a par with Eric Clapton and the others, you know. I mean, he was that sensational. And but it was the songs, you know, and which he co-wrote with Morrissey.
You sound very disappointed in the book about the fact they didn't do better in America. You say it's because they didn't have a manager.
Pardon?
You said that they didn't have a manager, which was the reason they didn't really do better in America, the Smiths.
They had managers at different times, but not for very long, as I recall. You know, but I can tell you that, you know, Jeff Travis, who really found them and called me and said to me, "Look, Seymour, I've seen this band, and I'm in love with them, and I know you. I know you now very well.
What was it
and
about
you're going to love them even more than me."
What was it about them that made you like them so much?
Everything. The songs, the music, Morrissey, Johnny, you know. And I do remember one thing, and, you know, I mean, look, Jeff Travis is one of the greatest music people, you know. I was with two of them last night, and unfortunately Jeff wasn't there, but Daniel Miller and Martin Mills and Jeff Travis are the three greatest music people I ever worked with, not just in England, but probably, you know, ever. These guys were great, and I'm almost forgetting the point I was trying. Oh, yes. Yeah, so, let me just go back a year. All right.
Okay.
Okay. I met Daniel Miller. Well, more than a year. I met a few years, but I met Daniel Miller at Rough Trade, and he was making these little records but it was him, you know, under fictitious names, he'd put out these records, and I put them out in America, you know. And, you know, he was very grateful for that, and I was grateful for the introduction and meeting him. And I woke up one morning, thank God, I woke up early, very early, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I had the NME there, or Melody Maker, or both of them, and there's a little article there that says, "Daniel Miller signs real band." And it talked about Depeche Mode. And I called up. And I saw that they were playing that night, you know. So I said, oh, my God.
In Basildon, wasn't it?
What?
In Basildon, in Essex.
In Basildon. That's what you said. Where they were from. Yes, I know they were in Basildon.
No, I know, but you do.
I went up there. But wait a minute, you're getting ahead. So hold your horses there, man. So anyway, so I called up, you know, the Concord, and I said, look, I just want to inquire, do you have any seats on your flight out this morning? I said, and what time is it? They said, oh, at 11 o'clock. And I said, and how much is it round trip? He said, $8,000. I said, oh, my God. And, you know, and I said, I want a ticket. And I just, you know, by that time I had a flat, so I didn't have to pack much clothes, you know, and all that. And I ran out to the airport, and I just made the plane. And Paul McNally, somebody said he might be coming tonight. Are you here, Paul? I guess not. All right.
In spirit.
And Paul McNally met me at the airport and drove me up to Basildon. And I was so blown away because there were a lot of good English bands around at that time. But and they made great records, too. But this band was also great live, and they were so young. It was their first, you know, official gig. I couldn't believe it, you know. And like I say, I'm a song man, but this was their first gig, and they were so good. I said, oh, I got it, you know. And I did the deal with Daniel Miller right then and there. Now, a year and a half, whatever it was later, I can't tell you the exact dates, but I get a call from Def Travis, and he says, oh, Seymour, I've seen this. And he was like, talk really like this. Oh, Seymour, I've seen this band, and oh, I can't get over them, you know. I said, I hope he's not in the order, but I don't, it's the truth, you know. And he said, but one thing, I guarantee you, you will love this band more than me. And I said, well, that's enough for me. Because he's got great ears. I said, I'd love to come over and see him. When's their next gig? He said, oh, no, Seymour, it's only in 2 days' time on the Mall, you know, in London. I said, 2 days? I said, I saw Depeche Mode the day they played. You know, I said, that's nothing. And I flew over, and I saw the Smiths, and I signed them, you know, with Jeff and, you know, together with him.
Probably. So one of your biggest signings, obviously, Madonna. You, yes, didn't go and see her. She came to see you, didn't she?
Well, she wasn't performing at that. She was just a singer. Yes. Well, I had there was this guy that did some work for me, and I thought he had a lot of potential. His name is Mark Kamens. And really nice young man. Unfortunately, he's passed away very young. But he says to me, look, he says, you're giving me these little jobs to do. He said, give me one of your bands to do. I said, I don't give my bands to anybody. I said, my bands pick their producers. I said, and unless I know something about, you know, that I'd rather them not work with the producer, or it's out of my budget, you know. I said, my bands pick their producers. I said, and I'm not going to change that. It's the least I can do. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, over the next 9 months or so, I want you to find six different acts, up to six different acts, and I'll give you up to $18,000, $3,000 a session to, you know, make demos with them. And Madonna was either the third or fourth, I don't remember, band or artist that he brought me. and I was in hospital, and he sent me the record, and I loved it, you know. And I was in the hospital for about 9 days, and I had to stay there for a total of 28 days.
What did you see in the record when you heard it?
It was a great voice.
How could you tell the potential of that?
How could I tell? I could have been wrong, but I wasn't.
You weren't. No, you weren't. Mercifully,
I've been,
not.
I've been wrong, you know.
Yeah.
I don't bat 1,000. I don't bat 500. You know, maybe 300, you know, but it's good enough. No, I just...
There are great moments in the book where you talk about the bands
Maybe I was just... Look, I certainly was having anxiety about being in the hospital. That might have played something into it, too. I don't... You know, I mean, fools give you reasons and wise men never try, you know? And you know who wrote that? Rodgers and Hammerstein. So, you know, they're pretty damn good writers, not me. Yeah. But so anyway, I just had a hunch. That really was what it was. And I said, look, I'm going to be here, you know, for a total of 28 days, and I don't want to wait. I think you should bring her here. I'd love to meet her. So that was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 2. He calls me up at 5 o'clock. And he says to me, I just got off the phone with Madonna. We'll be there at 8 o'clock. Well, I was, you know, in these old rotten pajamas and, you know, I probably hadn't showered. I certainly hadn't shaved. I got it all together. You know, I got people in my office to I even got a barber down and, you know, and everything. I just, you know, and... when she walked in, something told me, as much as I wanted her, she believed in herself so much, you know, so much, you know, and it was not phony. It was really, she is strong. I said, she just wants a chance, a shot, and, you know, I made the deal with her and with Mark right in the hospital room. So you know.
So
what would you say? And the rest is history, I guess. You
yeah,
say.
Yeah. But it was she had a drive in
she
her.
She had a drive in every way. First, she had a great song. Everybody's a great song, but she also, I could just sense this girl would walk through fire right to make it. You
but
know,
that must be what you're looking for a lot of the time with any musician who's got that.
Pardon me?
That, you must be looking for that with any musician, really, that idea of ambition, the idea that they really... I remember talking to Roger Waters, the Pink Floyd, once, and he said, musicians who want to be really successful we have holes in our psyche. We need to be, well, you know, on a huge stage. Yeah. And I thought it was quite interesting, actually.
There's a line in the book where you say ambition is basically dissatisfaction with who and where you are. You're born with demons that you have to harness before they kill you. You think that's true?
Well, I don't mean it in a bad way.
No, not remotely. Know. No, it's really interesting.
It's just it's very interesting.
Look, you know, first of all, by the time I signed Madonna or most of my artists, I had seen so many great artists, you know, that not that I worked with, just that I, you know, some of the things we mentioned, some of the doo-wop songs, some of the country things, come and go. Some of them, careers were finished. Some of them were dead, you know, died very, very early. You know, I remember as a kid meeting Buddy Holly. He came up to the Billboard offices and, oh, God, I was a kid. I mean, he was so talented and his career is so short-lived. So I'm almost forgetting what I'm trying. But, I feel then and I feel now that I owe it to my artists to try to do everything I possibly can, you know, to help them. And, I'm sure I failed, you know, sometimes. I'm sure I did. But it wasn't for lack of trying.
Is there any act that you wish you'd signed? You talk about missing out on Donovan, missing out on Jethro Tull. Is there anybody you just wish you'd signed and someone had got there first?
Well, I certainly like Donovan, and I didn't even have a record company. I couldn't have signed Donovan. But Donovan was a pie artist. There was a great indie label here in England. They had the Kinks. They had other you know, really good artists. And Pi distributed Redbird, where I was working. And I happened to hear Catch the Wind. What a great song. And I said, you know, you should pick this record up. And, George Goldner, who's the guy I worked with, he's a little mixed on it. But I think that they decided, you know, they were running so hot. The label was so hot. They had the Dixie Cups, they had the Shangri-Las, they were red hot. I think they figured, you know, what do we need this English stuff for? And they got picked up by a little tiny label in a country label in Nashville called Hickory Records. And but I loved that record.
Right.
I got to know Donovan. I worked with his son. His son had a band, and they didn't make it, but they were on Sire. And
that's one that got away.
Well, that's one that got away. Absolutely. I'm delighted you've been here to talk about this book this evening. If only because it's the first time on the podcast that anybody has been able to say I met Buddy Holly.
I met Buddy Holly. Oh, yes.
I'm enormously impressed that I've met somebody who's met Buddy Holly. You've had an extraordinary career, and you've been a unique vantage point to see all kinds of amazing things and people come along and happen, and they're all recorded in this terrific book, Siren Song. Would you please thank Seymour Stein?
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.